morning and welcome to the Sports Polygamy Podcast. I'm Eric George, and it is the 15th of November 2012. I am, as a sporting polygamist, am used to kind of divvying up my months into different sports because there's so much to keep track of. And for me, November and December are normally a time to kind of get on top of the NFL because all the winter sports in Australia are totally wrapped up. The NBA is kind of just getting going, and there's not normally a whole lot happening at this point of the year, so I can focus on the NFL. But that's not how it's happened this year. Everything's kind of gone crazy early on in the NBA season, so I've thrown out the bat signal, and I'm glad to have a return visit from Sam Monahan from NBA Nation Australia to help me break down the early season. How are you, Sam?
I'm doing very well, Eric. How are you about you, Matt?
I am good, thank you. Like I said, a little bit surprised by how much there has been happening in the league, but it's good. It's good to see an exciting start to the season for once from the NBA.
Are you keeping up with it all?
Trying to. It's a little bit hard. I mean, I've only got so much time and so much internet to follow so many sports, but it's even just watching the highlight reels of some of these games, it's been a heap of crazy games so far.
It's pretty incredible, including your Raptors a couple of days ago against the Jazz.
Oh, my God. In a typical Raptors loss as well. I mean...
Oh, exactly. Just fade away right at the end, hey?
Yeah, and getting killed by an Al Jefferson three that rolled in and out of the hoop about 17 times before it fell. That's textbook Raptors.
Down to a C, that one. Like, just little dink and dunk things like that. Going their way here and there, it's very, very Utah, and you know they're a very tough team to sort of pick on the road or at home.
Yeah, that's true. We'll get to the Raptors a little bit later because I don't want to be depressed through the whole podcast. But I thought we might as well break this down slightly chronologically as well. So obviously the big topic before the season really had even gotten going was OKC shipping James Harden off to the Rockets for Kevin Martin and some other draft picks and bits and pieces.
How was that on a Sunday afternoon? Yeah, came through. Incredible.
Yeah, it caught everyone by surprise.
I think that Houston won that deal just quietly. What about yourself?
Yeah, I think so as well, although realistically, for the Thunder's perspective, I don't think we can say straight away. I think that their moves are not, like, they're not here to win the regular season. They're here to make deep plays into the playoffs, so we can't really see how Martin's going to contribute unless he you know, carries them through some games late in the playoffs or he fades. That's when we can really decide for them. But there's no doubt that this has suddenly transformed a Rockets side that looked like it really lacked an identity into a really, really interesting side.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I'm not sure that they're maybe – I think they're a better team, but they're definitely a more interesting team. You know, tuning in to Lin wasn't that exciting, but tuning in to watch Harden drop to 37 and 45, that got me hooked. You know, sort of after game two and game three, that was pretty exciting. And like going back to your earlier point, I think that you'll see the Thunder's side of the deal pay off, you know, next season and the year after with those picks. They've been pretty good with those picks. So let's see what do they do with them, what sort of guys they pick out of the draft. They've been traditionally really strong into the draft.
Yeah, it's curious as well because this is a trade between two of the nerdiest GMs in the NBA. And it's kind of, you know, the Rockets have done very well through trades and the Thunder have done very well through drafting. So in some ways, this might be a trade that benefits both teams in the long term because it gives the Thunder more chances to work their magic in the draft. And somehow the Rockets keep kind of cobbling together these teams that, you know, they look like they could be a legitimately competitive team throughout the whole year.
They're at least going to be, well, like we mentioned about the Jazz, they're kind of going to contend and just hang around. They're not going to necessarily go away too easily. I mean, their biggest loss this year, I think, has been by 10 points, and that was at home to Portland 2 or 3 weeks ago. So, well, that's not too bad at all.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the Thunder, I mean, obviously there was a lot of panic buttons being hit around the league before they realized that the Lakers were going to implode, but do you think the Thunder should be too stressed about it at this point, or is it too early to tell?
I think it's, well, I'm going to be really difficult and say, look, it's too early to tell, but Martin's putting up some good points, and he, you know, you could look at him as probably one of the contenders for Sixth Man of the Year, alongside Jamal Crawford and the Clippers. So, Martin's not anywhere near the equal of Harden, I think. So it's a bit of lopsided in that sense if you're looking one-on-one. But I think he'll fit in quite well to the Thunder system, and we haven't really seen the Thunder play anyone of any note so far.
Yeah.
They lost by 2 points to the Spurs in their opener, but when we get to the back end, like you were saying with Miami, we judge them on the playoffs and they'll be there at the end of the season. What do you think?
I think one of the most interesting parts about this is almost an ultimatum to Russell Westbrook, because previously Harden was his kind of safety blanket. When they were playing together on the court, you know, Westbrook could try and do his selfish stuff and try and break it down. And if it didn't work, he could give it to Harden, who was more adept at running pick and rolls and running a more structured offense. Now it really falls to Westbrook to run a more complete and team-oriented game. And they're either going to live or die by what he does.
You're right. He's kind of playing almost a shooting guard role, and he brings the ball up. So it'll be interesting to see what they do with Westbrook. I think Ibaka's going to pick it up on the offensive end as well. He's just got more consistency. He doesn't necessarily need to score more points, but he's just got to give you something, you know, 10 to 12 points a night that you can bank on.
Yeah, absolutely. An improved Ibaka on the offensive end makes him a much more complete team. But it was certainly, like I said, an intriguing start to the season, which was made almost more interesting in the West by the Lakers, who I'm proud to say I was trying to pour a little bit of water on this before the season started. And it's just the NBA. Like, stuff doesn't happen overnight. The Mike Brown thing always looked a little bit suspect, and obviously he's been fired now, and they've hired D'Antoni. What's your take on the whole Lakers scenario right now?
I think last year they asked Phil to leave too soon. And from there they got themselves into a hole. They had to find something that was going to work out for them. And they went with the best coach who was on the market. And that was one of Popovich's disciples, Mike Brown. He took LeBron to the finals. He took a really, really crappy team to the finals. So I think they had the best person who was on the market. And then it looks like something's actually happened behind the scenes between Kobe and Brown to sort of get him offside. And I think that's where everything's gone wrong. Then you add the losses to it. You add Steve falling down, breaking his leg apparently.
Mm.
That's not, no coach is really going to survive a start like that, particularly when a star player goes down, unless you're a bottom feeder like, you know, Detroit or someone like that. And he's just caught in the wrong place at the wrong time ultimately. But I think that they probably looks like they could have had their man in Phil, but they seem to have chosen to go in a completely different direction.
Yeah, it's always curious in these cases. I mean, with both Phil and the Buss family and the Lakers, you never really are clear on what happens in these negotiations. They're both very strong-headed parties. So,
Is Phil going to be the brother-in-law to Jim Buss?
Potentially. It's all very strange in LA, but the curious thing about firing Mike Brown, like you said, for potential personnel issues, is he always had the reputation as a player's coach. He was somebody who they got in for LeBron because he would allow, you know, it to be LeBron's team, and they thought this was a way to appease Kobe in LA because he'd allow kind of Kobe to do his own thing, whereas, you know, Jackson spent a lot of his time as a Lakers coach, and it's obviously the same with Jordan, is trying to tame these egos and get them to play in a team-oriented kind of game plan. The fact that he came a cropper of Kobe and ended up, you know, getting fired because of it is a bit of a twist.
I heard a story a few weeks ago, just before the season started, that Kobe actually had been speaking to some of Brown's assistants and wanted to run this Princeton offense, and that Kobe was actually the one who instigated it. Now, I'm not sure, you know, where the truth is at, but maybe, you know, Brown giving Kobe the run of the team like that might have been his own downfall.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, bad start to the season for them. Bizarrely, defensively more than offensively, they did seem to give up a lot of points despite having a pretty gigantic front court. The thing for them, though, is then they go out and get D'Antoni. Now, I saw a lot of people get excited about this. Obviously, you're reuniting Steve Nash with kind of the coach that saw him through his best seasons as a Sun. I'm not totally convinced, personally, that this is a great fit for the team.
I like it. I love it. I think that same reputation. He's a player's coach, so everyone seems to love him. I think if scoring was their problem, they went after the right guy. They've got a guy who's going to absolutely turn this thing up to 110. They're not going to be scoring, you know, maybe 90 to 95 points a night. They're going to be dropping 105, 110, 115 a night. And they'll work out their own defense. Howard and Powell are good enough. Meta's actually a really good defender, no matter how much crap people give him. He may be crazy, but he knows how to defend.
Yeah.
And then you've got to sort the Blake issue out, but you know what? Once you bring Nash back, that's not a problem. You just got to bide your time until that happens. And Kobe is Kobe. You know, you give him the ball in the last sort of, 5 minutes? Game's yours. I think it's going to work out better for them because, as you've sort of seen in New York, D'Antoni just lets the players kind of play to their strengths and run to their strengths. And that's what I think is going to work well for the Lakers. You're going to see Dwight and Nash in a lot more pick and rolls and better pick and rolls. Mm-hmm. And they're just going to figure it out themselves. What do you reckon? What makes you so concerned about it?
Well, when I think about what made D'Antoni such a good coach at the Suns, it was speed and passing. And I'm just not sure these are things that the Lakers have. I mean, you look at that starting five. Nash is okay in an athleticism sense. Dwight is obviously a physical freak. The other three I don't think are particularly athletic at this point anymore. I don't think Meta or Kobe are particularly adept at passing anymore. I mean, Kobe is not willing and Meta is just too crazy to fit in a system. So I just don't see the fit from a philosophy standpoint with the personnel that the Lakers have.
Perhaps it's just simply a way to appease all parties. It makes the Lakers look like they're doing something offensively, like bringing in a really offensive-minded coach. It'll basically give the players run over the court. You know, the problem is they're going to be playing a lot of minutes, and I'm not sure if you caught Thursday's game where they played the Spurs, but they played a lot of minutes. Kobe, Powell, Dwight all played 39-plus.
Yeah, depth is certainly going to look like it's going to be an issue for this team. From a signalling standpoint as well on this team, it is curious that they went with D'Antoni because obviously Mike Brown was somebody they brought in, like I suggested, to keep Kobe happy. And now they've gone and gotten the pet coach from a different player and someone who you have to think will certainly be pushing the team more towards allowing Steve Nash to run the offense. An interesting tactical move, I think, considering how important Kobe's been to this team for so long.
Kobe's important in the last 5 minutes, though. You can let Nash look after the game and manage the game.
I'm just talking about managing egos. I'm talking about keeping Kobe happy, not in terms of actual gameplay production.
I think if Kobe's getting points and the Lakers are winning, then he'll be a pretty happy fan. He just wants to win another title, don't you think?
Yeah, maybe. I haven't seen it before. That's all. I've seen him. Like last year, he kind of, you know, was pretty successful at torpedoing those Lakers at different times, where he seems to have that instinct that he wants to have the ball and he wants it to be his team. And I'm happy to be proven wrong, but I just not sure I've seen him defer consistently yet.
Oh, I completely agree. The man loves the ball in his hands, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He just loves to shoot. He just wants to have a go. I mean, we saw last year he was the only decent player on that team. Powell's having a bit of an off year. And we saw, by the way, he got treated in the playoffs by the media, that he just got crushed in the media.
Mm.
And he was just having a bad year. And Kobe was the one carrying the team. Let's see if he can sort of give it up and sort of pass. You know, Dwight's had a good year this year so far. He's getting 20-plus a night in terms of points. So maybe that's all you need.
Well, yeah, it's a scary thought now with Dwight, who's had, you know, Jameer Nelson and a bunch of cast-offs passing him the ball so far in his career, to now have Steve Nash feeding him the ball on the post and on pick-and-roll situations. You have to imagine this will put his production through the roof.
It should, anyway. But your point comes back. What does Kobe do? Does he split reps with Dwight in terms of that? Or I reckon you just look at the team and you split whoever's playing well that night. Maybe Kobe has a great night tomorrow. Next night, Dwight's going to be having a great night. It's pretty easy to roll that.
Yeah. It's well, at the very least, it's going to be very interesting to see how it all unfolds. So other than those two kind of big landmark moments so far this season, there's also been some teams that have kind of surprised so far over the first couple of weeks and certainly deviated from the predictions that yourself and myself made a month or so ago when we did our preview podcast. Perhaps none more so than the Knicks, who, you know...
Oh, I was so wrong.
They've been playing out of their skin so far.
Wrong. They've been playing out of their mind. And the best stat I can give you guys, everyone who's listening, they're the best in defensive efficiency this year.
That's nuts.
Who would have thought that the oldest team in the NBA is actually the team that's producing the best defensively? It makes no sense to me, but congratulations to them. They're allowing opponents to score something like 87 points. They've got a point differential of something like 17 points. And for those of you guys out there that don't know quite what that means, they're scoring about 104 points a game and their opponents are averaging about 87. That's incredible.
Yeah, I mean it's only five games, so you're gonna get some crazy numbers early on, but it's still very impressive. What do you think? I mean, apart from obviously the defensive production, what do you think the biggest factor so far has been behind their hot start?
I think the fact that they started at home on the eve, like post storm,
yeah,
that's them rolling. That must have got it. It looks like it's got them charged up, ready to go. It's got those old legs re-energized.
Yeah.
I'm excited to be playing ball again. And perhaps it is the feeling of being in New York and this team being on just such a roll. At least it seems like all New York's behind them, with the Jets and the Giants struggling lately. It just seems like it's their time. I mean, their schedule's been pretty easy. They seem to have had 3 or 4 days rest between each game as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably contributing to it as well. But like you said, it's 5 games, but they're atop the, you know, the Atlantic Division. I think what the storyline with this team is going to be is when Amari comes back, what do you do?
Yeah, well, that's my thing as well. As I was going to say, do you think that the removal of Lynn as a distraction has really helped Mello, who's, you know, kind of a famously combustible guy, is a bit sensitive? Do you think the fact that this has been, you know, kind of his team to carry has helped him?
Oh, for sure. He's done something which he didn't get to do in Denver, which was grow up a bit, and he's leading this team on the boards and points. And he's got Chandler to fall back on, but you know, you're seeing guys like Novak and Felton and Kidd, you know, just sort of get him in the right place and then get the ball to him.
Mm-hmm.
Working really well for him. I think the more, you know, Camby needs to step up and things like that, but I think Mello has taken the leadership role upon himself. He's grown into it. You probably saw on before the Heat game how he got out there and thanked all the New York fans just for turning up on that night after the Storm. And that was a pretty, you know, who would have thought 4 or 5 years ago that Mello would be the guy, be a spokesman of a franchise like that?
Yep, you are correct. And you're also correct in saying that this is all nice to see now, but we'll wait and see what happens when Amare comes back. Sticking with the Atlantic Division, Boston was a team that everyone was pretty hot on before the season started, and they seem to have had the wobbles early on. I mean, they've had a couple of steadying wins more recently, but they're still only sitting at 4-3, which puts them a fair way back from New York, who are undefeated at this point.
You're right, and particularly considering they've had, you know, pretty easy schedule with Washington, Milwaukee, and Philadelphia thrown in there as well. I mean, they put up a great fight a couple of days ago against Chicago. Normally, Chicago kicks their asses.
Yeah.
That might be because they were missing Rose, but it was good to see them. Well, for them, it's good to see them get a win over Chicago in Chicago early on, just to get the ball rolling in terms of, you know, looking at wins and losses at the top of a conference. But I think, like you mentioned, they've just got the wobbles and they're just trying to work out what to do with Terry and also where to fit in Salinger. He doesn't seem quite like the big player and the big-time player that I thought he was going to be at the start of the year. I was quite high on him, so that might have been a bit of a sleep on my behalf, but I think we'll see him come good. Give him 2 or 3 weeks, and in November, I think they'll have a pretty positive record heading into December and into Christmas.
Yeah, well, you know, with a lot of these kids, you've got to give them time as well. It's a little bit too early to make a call either way. What about Green? Obviously, here was somebody else who, I mean, Simmons was hyping the living daylights out of him before the season. How have you thought he's played so far?
I think he's... they're not sure what to do with him. I think they let him run free during the preseason, and he showed that he could be a beast. But it doesn't seem like they know what to do with him. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't seem like Doc quite knows if he should play him at power forward, small, you know, shooting guard. They don't quite know what to do with him. I think that's where he's struggling, and they just don't know what to do with him. So I'm not sure. I think he deserves to be in their starting five because he's one of their five best, but maybe it might be a shortage of options.
Yeah, and the Celtics are such a chemistry-oriented team, you know, making the extra pass and all that's been such a hallmark of Doc's game plans with that team. So if he's not buying into that, there's no way he's going to crack the starting five.
No, and you're better off starting Pierce and Bass over him anyway.
Yep.
So because Pierce is still a better passer than him. And you know, he's been averaging 10 assists at least a game. He's on fire so far. I mean, he hasn't been scoring many points, but his assist numbers are off the chain.
Mm-hmm. You know, next division down on the whole table is the Central Division. It's obviously a bit disappointing for Indiana to have lost Granger, and they're in a little bit of a tailspin right now. I mean, God, they lost to the Raptors today. Detroit, disappointing yet to get a win, but perhaps the most surprising has been Milwaukee, who, you know, everyone said they couldn't play these two small guards together and they'd really struggle for consistency, but at 4-2 already, they seem to have figured stuff out pretty quickly.
They've done really, really well. And I don't know who it is, whether it be D'Alembert. I love Ilyasova, by the way, at power forward. I think he's an absolute beast. And we wrote a column during the offseason that we thought, you know, Denver should pick him up. You know, it fits perfectly into their system. But Ellis and Jennings, they're incredible. I don't think their energy and their accuracy is going to last.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been the biggest problem with Jennings. He's so hot and so cold. But they're exciting, and they're causing trouble for teams. You know, you chalk up Milwaukee as a win at the moment if you're betting against them or you're looking at them on the head on the schedule, particularly if you're heading into Milwaukee.
It's almost it's curious how they seem to have almost adopted the Golden State's, you know, strengths and weaknesses by just taking Ellis on board.
You're right. I mean, even you know, if they'd kept Bogut, they would probably be almost exactly the same team as Golden State this year as Golden State were last year. So it's going to be pretty interesting to see what they do with, you know, Gooden and Marquise Daniels.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not very deep as well. That's kind of like the Lakers. That's where their problem is. Their starting fives is pretty interesting and pretty deadly. But, you know, once you start bringing in your second unit and third unit, just rotating players,
yeah,
kind of messes up their chemistry.
And that's obviously also when the season wears on, as players start to get niggly injuries and, you know, the toll of the 82 games takes its starts to play its part. That's when the depth will really become necessary. And maybe you'll see some of those teams like Milwaukee fall back a little bit.
Just a little bit. And that's where you might see teams like Chicago rise up, I think, as well. That's where their strength lies. They're quite deep and quite strong defensively, and that'll keep them in a lot of games.
Mm-hmm. In the West, I think clearly the most surprising team has been Minnesota, who just was pretty depressing to consider their prospects once Love went down and joined Rubio on the bench. But at 5-2, I mean, Rick Alleman's looking like a pretty solid lock for Coach of the Year so far this season.
He's done so well considering the amount of crap he's been dealt, you know, injuries to his two biggest players. And then today, well, probably yesterday, I think it was now, that we saw Chase Buttinger go down as well. This team is falling apart. They're kind of like the Bombers of, you know, 2012, you know, maybe. But they're producing incredible results. Kirilenko is playing out of his mind since he's come back. Love, when he comes back, whenever that's going to be, is going to seem so much better, no matter how quickly it happens. You know, D. Will is an absolute beast on the boards as well, just quite. I think that's where this team's excelling. I don't think the guards are that fantastic, Ridnow and Broy. But, you know, they're going to cause trouble again. Like, I'm looking ahead on Denver's schedule. Not something, again, that I'm chalking win up to, and I'm not quite sure how we're going to shut down their big men or anyone's going to shut down their big men at the moment. Like, they're just strong and they're hustling people.
So, you know, you're suggesting that when Love comes back and then Rubio down the track as well, that automatically makes them better. But are we sure about that? Because there's some kind of crazy alchemy that's working in their favor at this point. And any slight changes, you know, introducing players who demand more minutes and the ball rotations all get changed, is there any chance that it actually gets screwed up by introducing better players at this point?
If there's anyone that's going to screw it up, it's going to be Rubio. But no, I think Love's mature enough to understand his role. And I think you sort of saw that on the US Olympic team. He wasn't getting a lot of minutes and things like that. But the minutes he was playing were just solid. He was getting points. He was getting, you know, 5 to 6 a game, bringing down 10 or 12 boards. So I think they'll know Love's role when he comes back. And they all seem pretty cohesive. They still seem to be on the same page. It'd be interesting to see what happens when Rubio and Roy are on the same court together.
That's a
pretty explosive combination. That could be pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm. Now, I won't let myself off the hook here. I feel like I should address the fact that Toronto has had a pretty poor start to the season so far, despite the fact that they did catch a lot of early season hype. Once again, Simmons was somehow talking them up, and a lot of people seem to be thinking they were a chance to have a breakout season this year. I will say I didn't think this was going to be their year. I kind of felt like this was the year before the year. A lot of young guys. I think they're going to get better throughout the season, but yeah, a lot of Toronto-style losses so far, like the one we mentioned against the Jazz in triple overtime.
Exactly. Are you happy with DeRozan, though?
Yeah, I love DeRozan. I mean, if he ever really gets that mid-range jumper more consistent and even an outside shot, he's so athletic, he's so aggressive. And the thing I've always really liked about DeRozan the best is that he genuinely seems to rise when he plays big games, when he plays against the big teams, when he plays against Kobe, when he has to guard the best players, he seems to enjoy the challenge. And I think that is something I always identified as a promising sign in a young player.
And it's a good positive sign. Is it time to get rid of Bagnani?
No, I don't think so. I think that Toronto's only real chance for stability as a team is to find these half-decent European players, because they're the only ones that are going to stay in Canada for any significant period of time. I think the biggest thing for Bagnani, he's never, ever had help inside. his best, the best interior player he's ever played with was Chris Bosh, who doesn't like to rebound or play defense. So if you can put Bargnani in a position where he's almost like a Dirk Nowitzki, where he can stray, play high post, you know, spot up for three-pointers and have an anchor interior player who can guard the key and help with rebounds, then I think that frees Bargnani up to just concentrate on what he does best.
Agreed. But I think the biggest problem with that is just getting someone like that to Toronto.
Yeah, well, the hope here is Valanciunas, who has looked okay so far, but it's too early, I think, to tell for a European player who's just made it to the NBA what he can do. But, yeah, it's just the great white hope. I think it's terrifying that we're pinning our hopes on an all-white interior game. But if any team can do it, I think it'd be Toronto.
If anyone, it's the Raptors, right?
But look, I mean, Lowry has been fantastic so far this season, despite obviously having some injury worries. He's looked like he's already made this his team. DeRozan's really coming on strong. Fields is chipping in. Like, there is no depth on this team at all. I mean, once you get past kind of six men, it gets pretty ugly. But there are some pieces, at least, for the side to build towards, I think, for the next couple of seasons.
Exactly. Little wins like you guys had today over the Pacers, that's in itself pretty incredible. Like, you went into Indiana and beat a team that pushed the Heat last season.
Yeah, the day after we played a triple overtime game.
Exactly. So there's some promising signs. Like, you know, bit by bit by bit, this team is coming together. It's too slow, but
there's no fast progress with the Raptors, my friend. it's a grind. But the reality is, this is a team who, if they ever won two playoff series, that would be the highest you could really ever place the ceiling for this team. So it's the kind of unfortunate reality with the NBA is you need to stay realistic with your expectations at some points.
Exactly. I'm surprised the NBA hasn't done more to sort of try and solidify this Raptors franchise. But that's different. Kettle of fish, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's an absolute – that's a whole other podcast in itself. But look, Sam, I really appreciate you coming on and giving us your thoughts on the early season.
Pleasure, mate. It's been fantastic. Thanks for your time.
No worries. I will be back on Monday with another podcast with a surprise guest live in person. Until then, I'm Eric George. Thanks for listening. See ya.